Blog Talk Radio.
The way we were and the way we are right now in Cleveland, Ohio. It's the American Sports History Podcast, hosted by my brother, a mentor and a friend, Peter Ray. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing it in Los Angeles. 347-205-9631. Catch the archive version on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports. Podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more him, less of me, let me lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic. The threes. First of all, Peter, how are you? Second of all, how can people get a hold of you? Third of all, your great guest.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. The channel name is my name, Peter J. Period REA. I'd appreciate any listeners who might consider subscribing to my channel. I'd appreciate that a lot. Yeah, you're right. Tonight's guest. Oh, wow. You know, this is American sports history, and once a month we have tremendous NFL history by an author of four sports history books. Bench Bosses, the NHL's Coaching Elite 2015, The Art of the Dealers, the NHL's Greatest General Managers 2017, Lords of the Gridiron, College Football's Greatest Coaches 2019, and we're continuing tonight to go through his most recent book, Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022. Welcome to the show, Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Peter, Mark, thank you so much for having me on. It's always a great honor and a privilege to be on this show. Thank you.
Oh, it's our honor and privilege because we get this term. You've done all this work, and I just love history of the NFL. Tonight we're going to be talking about Don Shula, Guy Chamberlain, Chuck Noll. So a lot of really good Miami Dolphins history and early NFL in the 20s and Pittsburgh Steelers history. So yeah. Matthew, let's start off with Don Shula. You have him listed six out of the top 50 coaches. What would you like to say about Don Shula?
The reason why I don't have him in the top five is that he lost five championship games. He lost the 64 NFL championship game, and he lost four Super Bowls. That really kind of told against him. I mean, he's in sixth place by a very thin margin. If he had been able to win one of those lost Super Bowls, he would rank among the top five, according to my calculations. I mean, it's kind of ironic. I mean, we remember him for the perfect season. I mean, this 50 years ago was the, 17-0. This was the magical year. But before that Super Bowl VII victory, Shula had a reputation of not being able to win the big one. I mean, it was like a cross that he had to bear. And finally, you know, this 50 years ago, he achieved his vindication when he led the Dolphins to their perfect season and their first Super Bowl title. But he was a magnificent coach, but it took some time. It's kind of like Tom Landry. It took Tom Landry 12 seasons before he finally won his first Super Bowl, and it was the same with Shula. I mean, he was a great apostle of Paul Brown, God rest his soul. I mean, you know, he played for Paul Brown, and later played for Weave Eubank, who was another Paul Brown apostle. And he also coached in college under Blanton Collier, another Paul Brown apostle there. So, you know, he was definitely from that Paul Brown coaching tree. And Shula, he was a brilliant mind. I mean, before he became head coach of the Baltimore Colts, he was defensive coordinator for the Detroit Lions. I mean, he was the one who devised the defenses that beat the Packers in that immortal 1962 Thanksgiving Day game where the Lions beat the Packers 26-14. Shula was the defensive coordinator. I mean, he coached the Colts. He got, if he, you know, any other team, his record with the Colts would have been superb, but, you know, he had those lost opportunities. He lost the 64 NFL championship game. He lost Super Bowl III, and he kept finishing second to the Green Bay Packers, you know, for the most part. And then again in 67, finished second to the LA Rams, you know, in the divisional race. So he had that hard luck quality. But the thing about Don Shula was when he went to Miami, that was the greatest decision that he ever made, switching over there. And when the Dolphins hired him, that was the greatest decision owner Joe Robbie did when he hired him. He was exactly what the Dolphins needed. I mean, they were five seasons old, and they were still playing like an expansion team under George Wilson. I mean, it was Miami Beach was Lotus Land, and no one was taking it seriously. Wilson wasn't taking things seriously. The players were just, you know, earning their paycheck. I mean, just content that we're to get a paycheck and all that. And Shula changed all that. He demanded that they play like winners and champions. I mean, when I interviewed Dick Anderson for that book, I asked him what is his main memory, a most enduring memory of Don Shula, and he said, Don screaming at us. And guess what, though? That screaming made the difference. In other words, there's going to be accountability. You are not an expansion team. I mean, the talent was already there. I mean, before Shula arrived, with the exception of two or three players, I mean, they didn't have Paul Warfield or Marv Fleming, and they didn't, you know, get Jake Scott, you know, as a free agent. But most of those players that played on that 72 team were already there. They were on the roster. But what Shula did was he got them to play to their absolute full potential. He got them, you know, in other words, he demanded maximum effort, and he got it. And guess what? They took it all the way. They had their first winning season under him, their first playoff appearance. In his second season at Miami, they made it to Super Bowl VI. I mean, they lost to Tom Landry in Dallas, but the following season was that perfect season, and they took it all the way. And then the following season, he won his second consecutive Super Bowl title. He was only the second NFL coach to do back-to-back Super Bowl titles there. And if it weren't for that sea of hands lost to the Oakland Raiders, who knows whether, you know, they could have done that third straight Super Bowl and all of that. But even after the glory years ended, I mean, the Dolphins kept right on winning. I mean, there was a little drought in the mid to late 70s where they weren't making the playoffs, but he was able to retool, keep them competitive. And then in 82, he took them to the Super Bowl. I mean, he didn't even have a dominant quarterback, but he got them into the Super Bowl. And even though they lost to the Redskins, you know, to Joe Gibbs. And then 2 years later, he gets Dan Marino. I mean, it was amazing getting Dan Marino. He's the last man drafted in the first round, and yet Marino becomes one of the most fantastic quarterbacks in NFL history, one of my personal favorite quarterbacks of all time, just watching him play, aesthetically beautiful. And Shula won with defense. He won with, you know, with the 72 Dolphins. He won with the ground game. Two running backs with 1,000 yards. That was a first in NFL history. He won with the passing game with Dan Marino. I mean, absolute flexibility. He had great defense with that no-name defense, the 53 defense under Bill Armsparger. It was just one of the all-time greats. I mean, if he hadn't lost those five championship games, he would rank among the top five. But a magnificent coach, absolutely enduring, and one of the all-time greats. And we salute Don Shula.
Yeah, and looking at my notes, Shula was only 33 when he got hired by the Colts in 1963, and people kind of forget about those years. And that's in 64. That's the last Browns title in 64 when Donald Shula was only 34. But then he had a 25-year run with the Dolphins. I really wasn't aware until reading your book that he lost five title games. And then these names, you know, that are so for me is my childhood: Larry Zonka, Jim Kick, Mercury Morris. You pointed out how his parents were Hungarian immigrants. Very interesting. And he was drafted to play as his playing career by Cleveland. So he learned from Paul Brown. And then with the Colts, you know, these iconic players, you know, Johnny Unitas here, Lenny Moore, Raymond Berry. And then with the Dolphins, Bob, and other guys with the Dolphins, Bob Greasy, Paul Warfield, Garo Yapremian. And then, Greg, you mentioned Marino. And then later, Mark Duper and Mark Clayton.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I have to ask you a question. You mentioned something here about Joe Ruby paying wooden nickels for Larry Zonka, Jim Kick, and Paul Warfield. Can you clarify that, Matthew?
Yeah, I mean, Joe Robbie, I mean, they didn't have, like, free agency like they had today. And Robbie was a bit – I mean, one thing, he became owner of the Dolphins. I mean, no one really knows how he became owner of the Dolphins. It was like he was able to get all these investors. They even had Danny Thomas, the comedian and actor and all that. A whole bunch of people investing money. It was always kind of like a balancing act. I mean, how did he become owner of the team? But somehow he held it together, but he was always on a bit of a shoestring. I mean, he was not the type of guy to open up his purse. He was not super generous. And when the World Football League emerged as a rival league, and 74-75, they were able to lure Zonka, Kick, Warfield with those big lucrative contracts. I mean, hey, they took the money and ran, and that really hurt the Dolphins. That kind of cost them, that's why they didn't repeat, in 74, and it hurt them in 75 and all that. It was just there was tight money there, and it was a bit of a problem. And even his relationship with Shula was not exactly perfect. I mean, Mark Hrabowski, in his very good biography on Don Shula, talks about, like, a brief time in the early 80s, Shula was thinking about leaving, exploring other offers. In fact, this is going to be crazy. When the USFL started, Donald Trump, when he took over as the New Jersey Generals, actually offered Shula a contract, and thank God Shula didn't take it. Praise the Lord. He stayed where he was. But it was – I mean – there were some moments when it wasn't perfect between Joe Robbie and Don Shula, but in the end, Robbie always did the right thing, and he kept Shula on, and it was the perfect ending for Don Shula in that sense. So it was enduring, but it wasn't exactly perfect. You just don't let a great man like that go. You do what you have to do to keep that sensational coach there.
Steve from Corvallis, Oregon. Wow, love your opening act. Peter, I have heard Matt before, just not a big fan of his opinion on Don Shula's perfect season 17-0 never being duplicated.
It is. That was the first season where I came into awareness in the NFL. I mean, Super Bowl VII was my first Super Bowl that I watched where I was conscious of it and aware as what it was and its significance. And I love the Miami Dolphins. I mean, they were my team. And, I mean, I remember for Christmas, I got actually those Miami Dolphins wristbands and all of that. And it was beautiful watching them. I remember watching that 73 AFC Conference Championship game on YouTube and just how effortlessly they sliced through the Oakland Raiders defense. I mean, Bob Greasy only threw 6 passes in that game, only completed 3 of 6 passes, but it didn't matter. They scored 27 points against the Raiders' defense. I mean, because they had offensive linemen who could open up those holes. I mean, that's the amazing thing about Shula's Dolphins during those two glorious seasons, that their ground game was so devastating. Bob Greasy didn't have to throw a lot of passes. I mean, he only threw 7 passes in Super Bowl VIII. I remember it was in the 71 AFC Conference Championship game against the Colts. He only threw 8 passes, only completed 4, but one of them was a 75-yard bomb to Paul Warfield for a touchdown pass. I mean, he only threw when he absolutely had to, and he had a great receiver in Paul Warfield, and whenever he did throw and complete to Warfield, it was always the big play, the big pass that broke the game open and all of that. It was just incredible to watch, now you begin to see it again with this emphasis on running, like the Eagles and all of that, with their emphasis on the ground game. It's kind of like it's nice to go back to retro style NFL football, a balanced attack, the necessity of establishing a ground game. You had Hall of Famer Larry Little, Bob Kuchenberg, Marv Fleming, these were great blockers. I mean, to see a ground game being executed to perfection, that was the glory of the Miami Dolphins.
Yeah, the 72-73 Dolphins. Yeah, I thought Larry Zonka was the coolest guy in the world. You know, I was 12, 13 years old, and he had a mustache, and he had that little bar on his a little like a loop on his face mask. And I didn't see anybody. But anyway,
yeah.
Zonka was tremendous. Player. We got a comment. Dan from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Heard the Oakland A's might be moving. 55 years in a city is a travesty to move. Do we just flush tradition down the toilet? How about you guys? Wake up and the Indians and Phillies move. How would you feel?
Well, Vegas is the growing city. I mean, they got a hockey team. Then now they got an NFL team. I mean, and it looks like they're going to get a baseball team. You know, you build a stadium to specifics. I mean, Oakland Alameda is a dinosaur and all that. It's been a dinosaur for quite some time. I mean, if you could have built them a brand new stadium, then they would get them to stay. If you build it, they will come. But, you know, you go where the money is. And I figure sooner or later, Vegas has got to get an NBA team too. I mean, sooner or later. I mean, you got that arena for the Vegas Golden Knights. I mean, why not play NBA basketball there? I mean, it's inevitable. Vegas is a happening city. It's the stigma's gone. I mean, you can do major league teams there, and I think it's inevitable. You know, sad for Oakland, but then hey, the A's started off in Philadelphia, then they moved to Kansas City, and then to Oakland. Why not? You know, hey, that's baseball.
Yeah, it's tough. We have Bill North on twice a month, every 2 weeks, and he's heartbroken about it. And it's a very painful reality that all sports fans deal with. Since the 70s, they were talking about the Indians leaving, and you know, I've been living with that ever since I've been a fan. But anyway, obviously it's going to hurt, and it would hurt any city. This is the prestigious thing to have, and you have the cities. Some are growing and others are not, and they have the money, and then they offer it, and then they leave.
Yeah.
And that's. Let's see, we got another comment. Gail from Fort Myers, Florida, season ticket holder for the Dolphins, who have not been relevant since Don Shula coached.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a struggle. I mean, Nick Saban tried his hand at it. You know, it just. You got to be able to draft the players, get it together. You know, you got to keep it together. You got to create a total package. I mean, right now, there's kind of like a vacuum, you know, in that AFC East. I mean, with the decline and fall of the Patriots. I mean, right now, Buffalo's filling that void. But I mean, if you can just get those defensive players, you know, keep Tua Tagovailoa, you know, healthy, perfectly healthy and all that, which is kind of a struggle considering what he went through earlier this season and all of that. I mean, that was crazy watching him, his fingers contorted like that. It's a terrifying thing. But, you know, you have to have a total package if you want to be relevant, you know, and a playoff performer and all that, and also have a team that can compete, you know, and win in those cold weather months, which has always been a Miami Dolphins problem, then, you know, it's just that's the challenge if you're going to win in the NFL, win in the Super Bowl, especially now that you've got regular season games going into January now, of all things. I mean, holy cow, man. It's crazy.
Lou from Rocky River, Ohio, where I'm from and where I am now. Hi, Lou. Lou says, hi, fellas. The Cleveland Browns need a Don Shula type. We're no good. Congratulations, Matt. The Eagles are going to be tough to beat.
Yeah, I mean, thing is, Eagles cannot relax for 1 second. I mean, they take on Chicago. I mean, Vikings are two games behind in that conference lead there. I mean, the Eagles got to keep going. They still haven't clinched the division yet, so they got to keep winning. They can't relax. They got to beat the Bears. That Dallas game, the Dallas game is going to be very important. If they can beat Dallas at Dallas, I think that will clinch things. And they have to maintain and stay healthy. I mean, it's still got a long ways to go. You got 4 games left, and God bless them, man. I mean, they're focused. They're defining ways to win, and I love them, man. I didn't think it would ever be like this. I was skeptical when Nick Sirianni became head coach. I thought he would be just like a puppet, you know, for Howie Roseman. But no, he's proven me wrong, and I take back every skeptical remark I ever made about Sirianni. I mean, God love him. I mean, let us hope and pray.
Now, moving on to number 7 in your list of greatest NFL coaches, Guy Chamberlain. What are your thoughts, Matthew?
A blast from the past. I mean, who is Guy Chamberlain? Simply stated, He was the greatest NFL coach of the 1920s. I mean, he was the first NFL coach to coach a repeat champion, 22 and 23 with the Canton Bulldogs. The first coach to three-peat because he took the Cleveland Bulldogs to the NFL title in 1924. And then he became the first NFL coach to win four NFL championships when he led the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets. Frankfurt, PA, is right outside of Philadelphia, to the 1926 NFL title. I mean, and even today, he still is the NFL's greatest coach in terms of regular season winning percentage. He's number one, still number one on the all-time list. If you have a minimum of five seasons of coaching, yes, 784. That is still the NFL record. Better than Lombardi, better than John Madden. I mean, yeah, you can look it up. And what he was he came out of the University of Nebraska, and he played in early versions of pro football, which there was before the NFL was formed, 1920. He played around with the Canton Bulldogs. He was a teammate of Jim Thorpe. And then when the APFA was formed, which was the NFL's predecessor in 1920, he played with the Decatur Staleys. He was a teammate with George Halas. They finished in second place that year. Then the following season, the Decatur Staleys won the NFL title, with Guy Chamberlain and George Halas playing with the team there. But the problem was Chamberlain and Halas were two powerful personalities, and there's only room on the stage for one powerful personality, and the Staleys were Halas's team. And I think both men decided there just wasn't enough room on the stage for the two of them. So Chamberlain went his own way, joined with the Canton Bulldogs, and that's when that's why he led the Bulldogs to three NFL titles, from 22 to 24. I mean, Halas later lamented, he said, "I should never have let him go," but actually it had to be that way because they were just two very strong, dynamic individuals there. It wasn't really a dislike. It was just a realization that there's just not enough room for the two of us. We need to go our own separate ways. And Chamberlain became the star player on that Bulldogs team. I mean, he was a player coach, which there was a lot in those days. There were a lot of player coaches. He was an offensive and defensive end, one of the best in the NFL. And when the Bulldogs were playing, somehow he was always making the big play, not just as a pass catcher, but he was good at doing end-arounds. He would do end-around reverses there. And on defense, that guy knew how to block kicks. I mean, in 1926 with the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, there was no postseason in those days. They didn't have the postseason invented until 1933. It was simply the team with the best winning percentage at the end of the season there. There was a key game very late in the season, I think against the Pottsville Maroons. He managed to block a field goal that managed to win the day, for the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets. And in another key game, he was able to block an extra point attempt to prevent a tie game there. I mean, it was just, he was always making the big play, and he was one of the early superstars in the early versions of the NFL. I mean, he's a forgotten figure now, but no, he was, I mean, using my rating system, he was the greatest NFL head coach of all time until George Halas and Curly Lambeau surpassed him, in the late 1940s and all of that. And may his memory live forevermore.
Yeah, that's so cool. I looked up on Amazon. There are no biographies of him. And I'm really interested. Going back and it's the NFL in the 1920s and people know. Who knows about that? So I find it interesting. Anyway, Canton, we're the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
That's right.
You can kind of see the connection there. And, here in Cleveland, I don't think very few people know about the Cleveland Bulldogs in 1924. I was at the Pro Football Hall of Fame one time with a friend, and he saw the silver football that Cleveland got for the 1924 championship. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I'd never heard of that until some years ago.
Yeah.
So cool. And I have a couple questions for you about Guy Chamberlain. The first is Frankfurt is in – I had to look – yeah, you're right. It's in the Philadelphia – had no idea where it was in the Philadelphia area. The first question is, do people in Philadelphia celebrate the 1926 Frankfurt Yellow Jackets title? And the second question is, in my notes here, you've got talking about Jim Thorpe invited him – he was farming in Blue Springs, Nebraska, and then he invited him to come to Canton. You want to explain that? Those two questions.
I mean, because Guy Chamberlain was a superb college football player at the University of Nebraska and in 1914 and 1915. I believe, if I remember correctly, he earned All-American honors. So Jim Thorpe was aware of him, and so he knew that he was a stud player. And it was just, it was very open-ended in those days. I mean, you just, whoever had offered the most money, you could get those players there. I mean, Newt Rockne played pro football for certain pro football teams, you know, in the late teens and early 20s and all that. It was catch-as-catch-can, kind of like a loose bricks without any mortar on it. And finally, in 1920, things got organized. But, yeah, Thorpe knew him, and they just – he drew – asked him, he want to join me, man. And, hey, Guy Chamberlain idolized Jim Thorpe. He was one of his favorite players. Hey, your idol asked you, can you play with me? Sure, I'll play with you, man. And that's why the Canton Bulldogs in the late 1910s were the top pro football team, you know, in Ohio, because most of pro football was in Western PA, Ohio, you know, Illinois, in that area. It was basically a Midwestern thing and all of that. Very, you know, industrial teams and all that. I mean, the Green Bay Packers, you know, they were company teams and all that. Decatur Staleys were a company team. And, you know, the guy who owned the Canton Bulldogs, he owned an automobile agency and all of that. And it was very, that's what it was. I mean, he was just a top player, and Jim Thorpe was lucky to have him and all of that. And they stayed friends.
Were Joe Guyon and Pete Kalik, were they American Indians also?
Absolutely, they were Native Americans, absolutely. They came out of that Carlisle Indian Institute. So, they played with Jim Thorpe. They played under Glenn Pop Warner and all that, yeah. And a question about Frankfort, PA. No, the Eagles do not celebrate the Frankfort Yellow Jackets because technically they were not a predecessor to the Philadelphia Eagles. I mean, the Eagles weren't founded until 1933, so there is no acknowledgement of the Frankfort Yellow Jackets. I mean, a couple of times there's been articles in the local papers about the Frankfort Yellow Jackets, but it's very obscure. I mean, it just, you have to be a pro football history nut like, you know, Peter and I, you know, to get into that and all of that. Yeah. They're not a predecessor to Philadelphia Eagles. They did not become the Philadelphia Eagles. No.
Well, it's the same thing here in Cleveland. There's no celebration of the 24 Bulldogs, although
right.
I'm interested. I'm a historian, and I'm a promoter, so I'd like to promote. That's what I want to promote.
Yeah.
I want to promote teams from the past. It's so cool. This is so cool. We're not going to be able to get into Chuck Noll and the Steelers, but Jim Thorpe, man, talk about an interesting topic, you know, and a fascinating topic. And here we're talking about the 20s and this, and maybe the greatest athlete of all time, and then and having, you know, American Indians playing in the NFL. You want to talk about Jim Thorpe and Joe Guyon and Pete Kalik?
Yeah, I mean, there was a team called the Oorang Indians. It was located in Oorang, you know, Pennsylvania. It was by a guy who owned a kennel, a dog kennel there. And it was composed by, you know, mostly Native American players, Jim Thorpe, Guyon, Pete Kalik. Like, to entertain in halftime, they were dressed in Indian garb and all of that. I mean, the Indians really didn't achieve – they weren't really a successful team. But the thing about Thorpe was he was – like, when the APFA was formed, he was the first commissioner. He was at that meeting I don't know if he was at that meeting when it was formed in 20 or not, but he was the first commissioner and all of that. He was an early star. And, I mean, he could do it all. I mean, not just run. He could drop kick. I mean, he could defend. He was just a truly outstanding player. I mean, he was an Olympic athlete, winning the decathlon and pentathlon, you know, at the 1912 Stockholm Olympics, played baseball. He could just do it all. And it was amazing to watch him. Thing was, there were times he didn't even have to do maximum effort. He might go at 50% or 75% effort. But even then, it was still astounding, and when he did go absolutely full out, he was just a devastating presence, and he was a wild and fun guy to be with and all of that. I mean, just he had a heart as big as, you know, as the Grand Canyon, but just the tragedy of his life where he lost his gold medals and all of that, and he was digging ditches at the end of his life there. I mean, it's kind of a shame, but I mean, in 1950, the Sports Writers of America voted to see who was the greatest athlete of the first half of the 20th century, and they voted for Jim Thorpe, you know, as the greatest male athlete of all time, and rightfully so.
Have you read the new biography by David Moranis, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe, that came out in August of this year?
No, not yet. I've been so busy, you know, with my own book and promoting it. It's
right.
not a knock on Dave Moranis. His skills are absolutely magnificent. I mean, I got his Clemente book and his Vince Lombardi book, and
right.
also his book on the 60 Rome Olympics. And they're magnificent. He's a magnificent and glorious writer. I hope to someday. I should.
I've got to read it because, yeah, I'm fascinated by Jim Thorpe and for what he did. And that just, of course, he played MLB and then this. He was playing in the NFL in the 1920s. Fascinating. Amazing.
Yeah.
Tremendous. We got
yeah.
a message here from Sal from Germantown, Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Phillies lost a whiz kid today. Kurt Simmons died today. He played, yeah, wow, won a World Series with the 64 Philadelphia Phillies. Kurt Simmons won 193 games, played from 47 to 67. Tremendous. God bless Kurt Simmons. Our time has flown by. The time is out. Our guest has been Mr. Matthew DiBiase, who's been talking about his book, Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022. Hope to have you on a month, 4 weeks from now. Matthew, do you have any final words tonight for our audience?
Yeah, it's up. My book is up on Amazon. It's on sale at 30% off, and it'll be remain on sale until after Super Bowl 57 is played. So go out and get it. It's a great stocking stuffer. Thank you.
Oh yeah, well it's I'm loving it, and we're gonna have to. I thought we'd get into. Looks like we tend to get about two coaches in. So next time we'll get into Chuck Knoll, and what a tremendous. That's gonna be
yeah.
an awful lot of fun because that's my childhood. Chuck Knoll and the Steelers in the 70s. Next year we're gonna have the starting center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's from the early 1960s. Bill North will be back. For the 12th time. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again, Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Thank you, Peter, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay.